Welcome to Big Talk for Breeders. My name is Michael Doherty, a show jumping breeder from the west of Ireland. And in each episode, I'll bring you a new interview with a successful sport horse breeder. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Now let's get started. This is episode number 22 with Patrick and Shane Connolly of Connolly Stud Farm, otherwise known as CSF. Recorded at their home in Galway in the west of Ireland. The Connolly family farm cattle and sheep, are agricultural contractors, while Shane is also a farrier. In addition to this, they also breed approximately 20 foals each year. The majority of those 20 foals are sold as foals, either privately or at public auction. And anyone who's attended a public auction in recent years would be very familiar with Patrick and Shane. Two gentlemen that always have time for everybody and whose horses are always turned out to a very high standard and have regularly produced sale-topping foals throughout the country. In this episode, we talk about how their breeding program started, how it's got to the numbers that it's at today, mare selection, selecting foals for the specific auctions, their success over the years, and in particular, we talk about the success and excitement that has been brought by their homebred Jamestown Crews this year in particular, arguably one of the most exciting young show jumpers in the world. Will you take me back to 1994, when you bought your first mare? What was it that prompted you to get involved in breeding?
It was something I kind of hate to do. Kind of started off. What happened was, I used to buy Cloverhill mares and sell them off again. Mm-hmm. And then we decided we'd go breeding. That's how it kind of started. And it was keeping an extra mare every year. And then we went abroad and bought a few Darko mares and that kind of stuff.
Were you looking for something specific when you bought that mare? Or was it just you kind of...
I suppose...
You came upon one.
Came upon one, yeah. With the Cloverhill as well, like, and that kind of stuff. And but it was actually Glazier Mint, Carnival Night. And we covered her with cruising. And we got a cruising filly, Comer Cruise. And we jumped her a bit, and then we kept her for breeding. And I suppose that was kind of took off from there then.
She actually bred Romero's Crews. He jumped 1 meter 55 as well. So it was a good start to the breeding program anyhow.
Oh, definitely. Something that you've mentioned, Shane, once or twice, and I think I've seen it in an interview before. You mentioned your Cloverhill mares. For those that haven't heard it, will you just talk through with... Was it your next two purchases, your next two mares that you added to the breeding programme? Your Cloverhill mares.
First two Cloverhill
mares. First two.
Will you talk us through the purchasing process of those?
I was down in Cork one evening, and this man used to buy an odd 4 or 2 year olds or whatever off. He said he had a Cavalier yearling for sale. It was sometime in August, and he wanted to go down to see him, but I was too busy to go down. We left it for a while anyhow, but he rang to come down. And I said, right. I said, I'm looking for a Cloverhill mare. Would you get one? He said, right. So he rang in a couple of days and he said, look, I have two Cloverhill mares lined up for you. Come down. So we went down and we bought the yearling and we went from there to see the Cloverhill mares and ended up buying them. That was the start of the Cloverhill job, as the fella said.
And now there's a crucial part now. You brought them with the lights of the Jeep.
That's right. Up on the hill in Macroom.
So, 12 o'clock
at night. When we decided to come home anyhow, we had forgot to get diesel. And I said, geez, every place is going to be load. But lucky enough, the men were buying the mares up had road diesel and he gave us some. Or we'd be walking home.
What did the mares look like when you saw them in daylight the next day?
Well, I didn't see them next day, so they rode away. They were grand. They were lovely. One of them was a draft mare, Clover Kine, Gold Kine Cloverhill breed. And the other one was Cloverhill, I think it was a thoroughbred horse, she was a clever fella or something. So the one that was off the thoroughbred horse ended up breeding a few horses that jumped. And the other one bred a few nice draft foals and when draft mares were dear, he sold her then.
Okay.
The one of the thoroughbred mare ended up being the grandmother of Vindy Cruz, that Shane Breen jumped in the Global Champions Tour there for Brian Cassidy.
So it turned out all right?
What or no good?
You must be a serious man now to buy a horse in daylight if you can buy them like that. You can buy them like that.
Go see John. Yeah.
We're now coming up on 30 years on from when you started off in your breeding program. There's a lot of mares have passed through your hands. You've had a mix of Irish and some that are bred in other countries. Did you travel outside for the mares, for the likes of the Belgian mares and that, and the Darko mares that you mentioned? Did you travel outside of the country to buy them, or were they already in Ireland when you had bought them?
Two that we bought that were in Ireland, and the other ones were from Belgium. Owen Horton, a friend of Dad's, was going out buying horses and buying foals to make stallions, and he used to pick them up for Dad because Dad won't fly, so that's how we
actually got into the first Darko mare. Owen was going out and he said he was going out to Belgium, and I said, if you can see a nice Darko filly foal or something like that, so he ended up buying a 2-year-old for us. That was the start. We still have her in the bunch out here.
That's Angie Van Pamiel is her name.
What had you so focused on getting a Darko mare at the time?
Well, watching the show jumping, there was quite a few of them jumping. You know, it's just, I'd be watching the show jumping, that's where I was kind of learning a bit about stallions and that.
That time Eurosport, every Wednesday night, there was the Volvo World Cup, or there was jumping on every Wednesday night anyhow, and that was the Wednesday evenings taken up anyhow, that had to be set down and watched and looked at. So that's how we decided, told Owen to get a Darko mare or Darko line or something for him then.
What was the kind of timeline from going, say, for instance, from 94 buying that first Glacier Mint mare to now getting to a stage where there are 20 plus mares? When did you really start to increase the numbers, or was it a fairly gradual?
It was gradual.
Yeah, he used to always buy and sell mares, and then we sort of got fond of an odd mare and we'd keep her, and then we wouldn't sell her, and then there was another one added to the bunch and another one, and then it ended up at 25 mares. And
I suppose Warrenstown, well aware, really, that was a Clover Hill mare we bought, and she had this cruising foal, and we sold her in courses. We got 6,000, which was a lot of money back then, and it kind of made you decide to keep an extra mare or whatever, you know, and that's how it kept happening. Like, you know, every year there was probably another one kept.
But you're saying, say, that Patrick was getting fond of them, but I read in an interview before, I don't know, was it your dad had mentioned it or advised you, like, to never be married to them?
Exactly. That's, I'll tell you a story while you go about himself. He would never, no matter what he had, he'd be going keeping it, but if someone came in and was giving enough money for it, it was gone. That was it. That's the way he done his business, like.
With that in mind, how many opportunities will you give a mare before she'll get the road? How many foals or how many chances will you give a mare, say, before you decide to move a mare on if she's not delivering what you want?
She'll only stay too long around if she wasn't delivering to a nice foal anyhow, number one. She'd be gone in a short while. Well, we're lucky enough, like, the mares, we do kind of breeding our own at this stage now, and so far, so good, they're all kind of turning out reasonably good, like, you know. Breed nice foals and things like that.
And you don't have to talk about specific mares, but say, I'm sure in the past, even, I think you've said it before, Shane, that's probably in the last 20 years that you've been breeding, say, more focused on show jumping, or in a more focused manner. So I'm sure in that 20-year period, there's been some mares that you had to make those decisions and move them on. In your breeding program, what does that process look like, or when and how do you decide to pull the plug, or things that you won't really forgive in terms of a broodmare?
Sure, look, if they're not breeding straight foals or whatever, that's number one. You know, you're straight away, you're an uphill battle thing for selling. Like,
I know we were just talking earlier on, Michael, and we were on about the scoring of mares, and you were saying you just look at them and you say, yeah, that's the one for me.
Like it or don't like it. Yeah,
but that's sort of the way we are. It'd be the same way here. Probably when we did decide that we were trying to go breeding for better, there was mares and foals that we actually just gave away as luck to people because we didn't want them. We found when we kept them ones, when we hit 3 or 4 year olds, we were still at the same problem as we were as a foal. We weren't progressing anywhere, well, only struggling.
Yeah, it would be going to sales and you wouldn't be getting money like for the fourth. So if that happens a few times, you'd say to yourself, it's time to be gone. That's going back the years, but
yes,
thank God that doesn't seem to happen, and we're kind of getting on better.
They're delivering.
They're delivering, well, yeah, that's the word.
Hopefully, anyhow, they can.
Hopefully, they go on and jump in.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you're going out buying a mare, either past or present, have you a particular type that you're either looking for or that you like? You know, is there a kind of a consistent type?
Not too big.
Not massively big. Like,
yeah, 16.1 is...
to 16.2, like, maybe, yeah. They're certainly no...
And maybe even 15.3 or 16 hands, if they have a bit of length or a bit of depth to them that... and the pedigree to match, then as well, we'd be happy enough taking them as well. We actually, one of the smallest mares we have on the farm, a fella bought a foal after this year, and he bought a few foals, and he said the most mare he liked on the farm was the mare that's 15.3 and loved just the way she's a super canter and go to herself. That was the most reason he bought the foal. So,
oh, she had a nice foal. Yeah, she had a foal as well.
In all the mares that say that you've bought, I know you keep your own homebred fillies as well to add to the breeding program, but of all the mares that you've bought over the last 20 or 30 years, which purchase has had the greatest influence on your breeding program?
The Clover Hill mare that bred Teddy Cruz, really.
Yeah, sure, you'd have to say that with James Ken Cruz. Yeah. There was a Darko mare there as well, Vista Van de Farm. She bred Kruko, he jumped 1.60 with Alex Duffy, and Falco jumped with Lucinda Roach. He was third and sixth, I think it was, in the Junior Europeans with Lucinda as well, so that was another mare that helped.
Yeah, she was one of the first Darkos we got to.
Hmm.
She produced a good few horses now.
Yeah. Similarly, looking back on all the mares and the purchasing over the past 2 to 3 decades, I'm sure you've been offered a lot of mares or gone to look at a lot of mares. Is there a mare that sticks in your mind as the one that got away?
Well, I suppose the answer to that, you forget about them. If you don't buy them, you have to forget about it.
Well, that's good, yeah. Yeah.
There is. I actually can't think of the name of the horse now. You left it.
That's all right.
Iron Man from Kilkenny. Ronan
Byrne.
Do you know his good heart, the horse he bred?
Urban Sea.
Yeah, he actually rang us to buy her at one stage, and we didn't.
The Guidam mare.
Yeah. And we didn't buy her, but she would have been one to have purchased. Yeah.
She's the one that bred Rockwell.
Yeah, RC. Yeah. That's, I couldn't think of his name. Rockwell RC, yeah.
No, it's just interesting because, you know, there's so many horses that kind of cross your radar, and obviously you can't buy them all, but I was just curious with the amount of mares that you would have had over the years. I was wondering, was there anything that had come up and for whatever reason you didn't buy?
Yeah, she was definitely one. I always said to Dad we should have taken the plunge, but...
Now, thankfully, the ones you did buy have worked. Have worked out. Moving on to the fillies that you breed yourself, and when you're making the decision for those homebred fillies to enter your breeding program, what's that selection process like? What are you looking for, and kind of how do you decide whether or not a filly is going to be retained to enter the program?
The pedigree, and plus if she's related to other offspring or whatever, and we give her a jump and see if she's athletic enough. That'd be kind of basically it.
And sometimes then they're decided as soon as they're born.
Yeah, that's it.
Then it's a filly. That's
she's dead, she's nice.
We're standing there looking at her. She's not going anywhere. But.
And are there standout things like when you say she's nicer, you decide, say, for instance, you decide in those first few days even, what is it that you're deciding on?
Probably the first thing, even though people don't really think about it, is when a foal has a nice head and it looks at you with this little cheeky look, and after that, you'd like to see it when you let it out the field with a good canter, nice rein. You sort of know that it'd be a nice model, that'd be...
Yeah, what would catch your eye, like if you were out some other where, you know, you'd have an old thing. For deciding whether you like something or not, to look at number one, and then you look at the other into the story. You know,
is there kind of a set number, or a rough number, or average in terms of the number of your homebred fillies that you'd keep to add to the breeding program, or is it completely different every year?
No, you'd have specific mares like this producing the goods, so you
keep a filly off it.
But, you know, we wouldn't be keeping a filly off her every year. We'd be selling away, and then if she's getting old, you'd say to yourself, it's time maybe to keep the line if they're starting to do something, do you know?
Some years we don't keep any foals, we sell
yeah.
everything. This okay. year we kept one foal, it carried into a Cornish Cannon mare. There was a year or two, a few years ago, we kept, mares were getting old, and it happened to have the three mares we wanted fillies off, or four mares came in the 1 year, so we kept them and didn't sell them. But we don't really say we're keeping two foals every year.
No.
They're nearly always sold as foals.
Okay.
Maybe in odd time we'd say we'll hold on to one and just put it into the sport for a bit of fun. But.
And has that been in more recent years that you've started holding some? Like, was there a lot of years there where...
There was a lot of years.
A lot of years, just, yeah.
Everything was sold as foals unless they were being kept.
Yeah, because the mares we were buying were young at this stage. Now there's a lot of them moving on, like, you know. There's mares there that's 24, 25 years now, still breeding, like. But they came from an earlier, you know, bunch, so we weren't keeping them then, like, for now. It's just keeping ones that fall those lines that we think is worth keeping them. So that's how it's done.
You're covering now in 20 to 25 mares in a given year now?
Yeah.
What's your process for stallion selection? How do you do it? Who gets what job? Who gets the final say?
We all have to see.
Yeah, it's between everyone, really. We probably this time of year now, at Christmas time, there'll just be a big debate about all the stallions we're thinking of using and try and match them as good as we can. Then with
mares. You have to keep trying, and it's not always going to work out, but it's been, don't ask me how we're doing it, but any stallion we select kind of seems to breed a nice foal or whatever, you know, that we have very little real ugly foals or anything like that, you know, so they'd have to be like the top horses, we say the ones we're breeding, if they're breeding jumpers and that kind of stuff, you kind of follow it and hope do one for yourself.
It doesn't always work like that either. Sometimes I can't get semen for a horse, so it's okay. What are we going to use now when it's thought up in seconds? And it does work out too, like, but...
And do you start off trying to find stallions for a particular mare, or do you have a list of stallions that you'd like to use and you're deciding...
A list of stallions we'd like to use, yeah, and that we think it'd suit our mares. A lot of the mares are much the same. You probably know from walking around, Michael, they're nearly all the same types anyhow, so it's basically one stallion 90% of the time probably match each mare, but it'd be different reasons we'd change or that sort of.
Do you have any preference for older stallions or younger stallions?
Well, the older stallions are nearly always the ones that you have to wait on their older to find out if they're producing, we say 160 horses or whatever, so they were the ones you'd be trying to use and hope. The younger stallions are grand, like, but they're very fair back. You have a good weight for them to know what they're going to produce.
Yeah.
What
when
not,
you're
you know?
Selling as foals as well, not as much now. It's easier to use young horses here now because everyone is...
If you have a nice foal now out of some of the young horses there, you can sell them. But up to this, if that wasn't happening, you had to have the full pedigree both sides, like, and the jump, really.
It changed a lot, though, and in the... couple of years when I was only young at the time, but when we were in Gore's Bridge with the first Eric O'Meara and her foal, and this man came over asking about the foal and the lovely foal, and what was the mare, and they said Darko, and I don't know what name, we'll just say, is that Paddy Stallion down over the road? Like, it has come on a lot since then. Even we were only saying this year when we started breeding, one time you'd have a mare, you'd have maybe a Clover Hill mare, Cavalier mare, but you'd have no reference to back performance, like it'd be just Cavalier, King Diamond, Cloverhill, whatever. And we were, you'd say, use Darko on them or use whatever stallions you want to put in, doesn't matter. Whatever stallions at the time were good enough, but they were at the top. Voltaire, different stallions, and them foals are selling gone at big money, and no reference of where now if you said to a lad that you wanted to sell a foal off a mare with no performance back to it, even if it was off whatever horse you want, the top horse in the world, they're still not going to
make a fortune.
Yeah, it has changed
a lot. No, it is very nice foal. There is another one that makes a bit of money, like, all the time.
but it wants to be very special without the page.
Without the page, no, yeah.
And that's not even that long ago. No, like that's even 10 or 10 to 15 years ago.
Definitely.
This is a hypothetical one now, but if you could have unlimited free coverings to any living stallion that you wanted for the next 5 years, who would be your front runner? You don't have to agree on the stallion now. You can have one each. Somebody said no stud fees, and you can get the semen whenever you want.
Cree right now breeds very nice stuff, like, and they seem to be coming out to jump away now as well. There'd be a good few stallions, like, you know, it'd be hard to decide maybe which one in particular, like. Sirocco Blue is another horse. You know, if you get the right mare, he breeds very nice horses. Like,
do you have a front runner?
There's a lot of them there, like, you know.
Yeah, I'd be probably picking maybe like the Cornet. He was a fond one of ours always. We actually spent a lot of money trying to get foals off him.
I just had that thought.
Yeah, when he was
in the earlier years.
When he was a 6-year-old, Dad, we seen him jumping and Dad ordered semen, but we got no foals for a good few years off him anyhow. We had a lot of money spent before we got our foal, but I'd go with Cornet anyhow.
It's fairly rare that you'd go to any sale in Ireland now, particularly the elite sale, and not see a CSF foal in it. What's your process like? How do you decide which foals you're going to which sales? Like, what does that process look like when you have your foals on the ground? How do you decide where you're going with each one?
How do we decide?
It's picked the dam, I suppose, that have the performance pedigrees first, anyhow, and the sire. And as to what sale to go to, it depends on their age, and some foals might look good enough for the earlier ones. So you'd be trying to.
Would have a big factor in it, because not always we have any foals.
Well, we might have early foals, but it mightn't be the foal we want to bring.
Yeah, that can happen too, but there wouldn't be all. Some years you might have a good lot of late foals, and they're probably off the mares with better, maybe pedigree or whatever, or
performance.
Yeah. So it just depends, if they're too young, you can bring them to those sales.
When you have your selection days in July as well, or first week of September.
Some of them might be born in for July.
Or August, July, it is. Sometimes we'd have foals, but you wouldn't be able to bring them because there would be too babyish to go.
We would have foals in August as well, some years.
Mm. And one thing that's really stood out as long as I've known you is when you turn up at the sales with mares and foals, your turnout is top notch. Like your presentation, the foals, the mares and foals always look super. It's generally reflected in prices you end up getting at the sales. Well, what does your foal prep look like at home? How long are you working towards a sale with foals? And obviously you have the advantage of being a farrier as well. You can have them nice and tidy and all feet pointing in the one direction. But like, what?
I don't know about that.
Do you have a kind of a similar process that you work with each of the foals going to those auctions?
Not really, just be sure they're looked after, they're dosed and all that kind of thing, see that they're thriving away well with the mares or whatever.
Yeah, we'd sort of be monitoring them during the year, really, as we're going along.
To be routine, like, that you'd be keeping an eye on them.
They'd be on a good worming dosing routine, really, for a young age.
Do you do a lot of walking?
Walking foals?
Mm.
We used to. Not as much now. Let the mares do the walking.
We actually start handling them when they're 10 days old. We have an indoor and we let them trot around on the lunge lead after the mare. We lift their feet. If it's a nice day, we bring them outside and we just hose their legs just to get them
used to things.
And for getting ready for sales, then they're just don't feed a lot of meal to foals either. They're grass fed. Okay, coming to the near the sales, all right, the last few weeks they would, but up to that they don't. It's just a good warming program, really, is the main thing. We find that's good.
From this year's foal crop, how many foals would you have hit the ground alive and well this year? As in 2022, the year just gone.
With 20 foals born on the ground.
And as an individual, do each of you have a standout favourite foal? Not necessarily the one that, you know, was the highest in an auction or had the best pedigree, but did you have a Do you have a favourite fold that you like going out looking at every day?
There was a few of them this year that were nice. There was a nice Grand Dorado call fold and a Tangelo filly fold as well.
Yeah, and a Hurley fold, very nice fold.
They were folds that were sold at home.
Can I ask out of which mares?
The Tangelo is out of Lady at Last. The Grand Dorado is out of Fever 3. She's a 4-year-old mare. She's actually gone into the sport now.
She's Glasgow.
Yeah, she's by Glasgow, yeah. And
Dream of Glory
then was the mother of the Hurley Cold Fold. I'm sure the folds that were in the elite sales, they were nice folds. We wouldn't anyhow. We were happy enough to have them at home if no one came to buy them. We were.
Do you have any idea how many CSF horses have been registered with the FEI?
No. Oh.
Would you take a guess?
I haven't a clue.
As of this week, I think there are 45 different horses that have been registered. I think there are over 85 registered with Show Jumping Ireland. You've had a young horse champion in Dublin. You've had a medalist at Lanaken. You've had a 5-star Grand Prix winner in the American Gold Cup. You've had an Aga Khan winner at the Nations Cup in Dublin. So it might be fairly obvious, but firstly, I want to ask, what are each of your proudest moments as a breeder?
Oh, I'd have to say Dublin anyhow.
Yeah, it was
class.
The buzz, the feeling of it, when even if you never done good to get him into the Nations Cup and into the Grand Prix, when you were standing there watching them going in, it was an unbelievable feeling.
And trying to keep your feet on the ground. it was definitely the highlight of the year for me, like, you know, when the whole family was there and the grandkids, it was, you know, a great occasion.
When we decided, I suppose, 20 years ago that we'd try and focus on breeding for show jumpers, that was our goal, yeah, it was to hopefully someday breed a horse that could either jump in one or of the either are that I've done, but to have one to be on the winning team and then to finish third on the following day or on the Sunday was made it even extra special. That was, hopefully now we can go and have another one in a few years' time that'll come in and do the same.
Definitely.
But, you know, the week after the show, you were still kind of pinching yourself. Did it really happen? Like, you know, it was great to see him in the Grand Prix. Like, was very, you know, he was very good as well.
Definitely.
Hard to leave.
He wasn't making up numbers.
No, great. No, it was seriously good. Yeah. Because I didn't expect that he would finish as high up in the Grand Prix, because you know yourself, it's...
He's very young and he had the mileage at that stage.
Yeah, so to get in it, and if he went around respectable, you'd be saying it was great.
Yeah.
But to be third in it was mighty.
If you had to pick two other days in the past 20 years to add to your top three proudest moments, does anything else come to mind?
One of them would have been when Dad won the Breeders' Prize in Dublin in the RDS back in, I think it was 2012. We were actually at home here getting foals ready for selection day for the elite sales. And the elite sales selection day was on Monday, I think, and we were back on Saturday evening anyhow to get them ready for going. And they rang to say that we're after winning it, but we weren't there to collect it, but a friend of ours collected it, but it was...
I thought it was someone pulling my leg, like, this girl was on the phone. She said, who is this? I couldn't believe it. Like, so there was actually a friend of ours there. She said, can you be in Dublin in 2 hours? I said, no, there's no chance of that. So there was a friend of ours up there, and I got him to collect it. Right, even then, he went on holidays for the week, right? And he wasn't home. So I wasn't believing it until I seen the trophy. I came home.
That's a good target to have, to win it again when you are there.
Yes, hard to do now though.
Have you any particular goals or targets that you do want to achieve in the next even 5 to 10 years? Or even, I'll put an add on to that might make that easier. Either goals within the industry that you'd like to breed something to achieve something or win something, or even a change or development you'd like to make at home in the next 5 or 10 years.
Well, I'd be hoping that we get a horse into the Olympics and do well. That'd be one of the... We got to the Aga Khan, we'd be trying hard to know.
If he gets to Paris, will you line out?
We'll see.
We'll have to drill them to get them going.
When and why did you register the prefix CSF?
We done it in zero.
I'd say about maybe 06 or 07 or something like that. Yeah.
And what prompted you to do it at the time?
It made it simple to follow your horses, like, you know.
It was a help, and yeah.
It was very easy to follow them, you know, the CSF, you knew if it was your own, you know, and to be into the tests or whatever.
We were able to build our sort of our, I don't know what you call it, like our herd or our brand or something as well. When we went to the sales, you'd get people saying they looked at the catalogue to see where the CSF was. So it was a help that way as well. That was, I actually don't know why or how we decided, but
well, that was the reason, really, yeah, because, you know, if there was horses to do well, it was harder to follow them, right? You know what I mean? So, like, if the CSF there, if you go down through the field or whatever, at least you see what it is easy to know without having to go into detail work to find them, you know.
Did you have any thoughts, or what was the feeling when it was dropped off Jamestown Cruise?
So I think it's a shame, really, like, and it has happened to us several, it's not Jamestown Cruise, but other horses that were sold. Yeah, a good few. And they disappear over the limelight, didn't you? Like, if you don't know what name they're changed or whatever, unless you're a whiz kid at this computer or something.
Yeah,
I think it, you know, when they're named, it should be like a person, that's it. I don't see what's wrong with the CSF or whatever prefix in front of it, and let them put on whatever. If they want to change the name, that's fine. There's no problem. I have no problem with that. But I would love to see the names having to stay on this prefix.
Yeah, it would be nice if he was CSF, whatever, Jamestown Cruise coming into Dublin. Now, it was nice that they kept Jamestown Cruise because he was named after the first grandchild of my nephew, so that's nice that that's on him anyhow. It is.
Definitely.
Adds to the story of making it special for him.
At the Dublin Horse Show that you just talked about, especially after he had won the Nations Cup and done so well in the Grand Prix, and then again similar chat in Geneva, you hear different people, breeders, riders, people involved in the sport, talking of Jamestown Cruise as being one of, if not the best 9-year-old, not just in Ireland or in Dublin on that weekend, but in the world. And I'm sure that's lovely to hear and all that, but then how do you quantify who's the best 9-year-old in the world? So I reached out to Sam Watson in Equi Ratings, and they have a rating called an ELO rating, and they rate horses. They give ratings to horses based on what they've won, based on who they beat. So I'm just going to go through some stats, because you mightn't have seen some of these, but I told Sam that I was going to be interviewing you on the off chance that they had some stats to hand. So this will just kind of put it into perspective. So this was in the last week. This can obviously change with different competitions, yes. But in terms of all the 9-year-old horses in the world on the ELO ratings, where does he rank?
Well, he's first anyhow at one stage, but I don't know now.
He's still first, and he's first by a considerable margin. And that's what was really interesting, because you can have a horse and go, oh, he's the best in the world, but like to actually see it, and he's ahead of some very impressive young 9-year-olds. So then Sam also sent me a rating where it showed in the last 10 years the ratings of 9-year-olds. So there are 3 horses with a higher rating as a 9-year-old: Explosion W, Big Star, Eddie Blue. And I think that's exceptional. It's not just a year in isolation. It's like he's the best 9-year-old of this year. Okay, let's look at the last 10 years. Like, these are household names of the world of show jumping, Olympic gold medalists. So then he also sent me a stat to show how he compares with all the Irish show jumpers, like, say, all the, we'll call it the team horses of all ages. And it's been an exceptional year for Irish show jumping. And he's still number one. When you see and hear things like that, how do you feel? Or what do you think?
I feel great. Why not? And just hope that the horse stays safe and progress away.
Yeah, it's nice to hear. Yeah, you'd be able to think about it anyhow when things would be gone. going wrong and those here in the farm, you can...
The bad days, you can think of turning him off, have a look.
And I think it's great, and you'll probably have known it more because people are obviously reaching out to you, but what I have really enjoyed with James Cann Cruise's success, Dublin, Geneva, seeing him, I suppose especially Geneva just took it up a notch as well, because it's really the best combinations in the world. But what has been really nice is I think an awful lot of other breeders are feeding off it as well.
Yes, yes.
It just shows everyone what's possible. This horse bred in the west of Ireland, you know, that would have been running around the fields here in Galway, is now, to the onlookers and to the statisticians, he's the best 9-year-old in the world, and in a ranking there with the likes of Big Star, Explosion.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, really. Like, when you hear it, it's nice to see that it's paying off. Anyhow, there's plenty of hard years and torture out in the farm there. Yeah.
No, definitely.
And disappointing days as well.
Mm. But it's great. I suppose that's the nice thing about breeding, is that everyone can get a buzz off even someone else's success. And I think what's been really nice is to see, looking on, how happy people have been for ye. But it also says a lot about ye. It's not just about the Irish horse. I think, you know, you're held in very high regard throughout the industry. And I think, say, when you put up the post, even in Dublin and things like that, the support or goodwill or the buzz that it gave everyone was huge, which is lovely.
Yeah, I think the fact as well that he's with an Irish rider at the top of the level now, who was produced in Ireland and bred in Ireland, and off an Irish dam line, which is, I know he can be Irish bred, which maybe not, but he's cruising Clover Hill. I think it's making it, people are getting more into watching, you know, following him from...
Yeah, and I think, especially around Dublin, there was probably a while where people were a bit disheartened on the show jumping front. It almost felt like, we were still up there at breeding the eventers, but it almost felt like having those calibre of Irish bred show jumpers with either Irish or non-Irish riders seemed like a distant dream. And I think Dublin having Kilkenny from another Irish family, bred by Brennans, and then having James Cann Cruise from an Irish family bred by yourselves, even on the team, and then to go and win it, and then the calibre of those two horses, they're not making up numbers like they're top horses. That kind of lights the fire in an awful lot of breeders to show them.
That's great. Show them what's possible.
Even in the Grand Prix on the Sunday, you had C Top Blue as well, bred by John Mead and James Mead there, which is great as well.
It's in a good place.
Yeah, hopefully it'll stay along that way for Edward. When we got a mare in from Germany one time, at the time the horse board wouldn't register because it was by an unapproved sire here. And can't think of the man's name, they came back, and but he came back to microchip the foal or register the foal for us. And he was going through the book and telling us, like, 30 years ago in the mare's line, like, all the Irish horses that were in her family, like, in her dam side. And he was saying, everyone in Ireland tried to go breeding to get to the top of the level, he was saying it'll take about 60 years from going on what they'd done to start off from scratch to get to build it up to where you have horses being able to compete, which is...
It's probably the best thing he could have said to you, because you're pretty determined to prove him wrong. You did it less than half it. Aside from the obvious superstar that we've just talked about in James Cann Cruise, who are the up-and-coming homebred horses that either we as onlookers or you guys are really keeping an eye on? Like, the ones that are probably out there doing the young horse classes, are there one or two standout ones that really excite you or that you really like what you're seeing?
There's a few six-year-olds this year that have come out there now and started that look promising anyhow. You have Olympic Jewel there. We produced her ourselves and sold her at the start of the year there. She was jumping in Centaur with Gary Dooley there at Juniors thing, and she won the 130 there. Lily O'Dea and Claire as well, Martin and Lisa's daughter, they had Carrera, a six-year-old as well, jumping out there, and she competed well there as well in 130s. Whipper Snapper as well, Ivor and Olive Broderick have him. He's by Sirocco Blue. He seems to be coming on nicely as well there. And Martin O'Dea actually has a Glasgow brother there, Jackpot. He's half brother to James Cann Cruise. He's going well as well there at the end of the year. So Hopefully,
so we'll have some good days ahead.
Hopefully.
Clack up another few miles.
That's right.
Something that we discussed before we started recording is obviously there's a lot of good days in this, but there's been a lot of good days this year, but there'd want to be because it can be a very challenging endeavour. At the different maybe moments that didn't go to plan over the years, was there ever a moment that you considered stopping breeding?
I suppose on the spur of the moment, you'd say when you see something wrong, say, that's it, but sure, look at it.
I was going to say, maybe for a day or two.
They settle down again, you go to see a nice photo or something like that, you say, forgot, that's it, away you go again. That's it.
Probably when that cruising mare we were telling you about earlier on, she completed 140 and her fourth dam was Ravina's Ed, and we never got a fall off her after Reiner. She absorbed her first fall and she died falling into second fall, but that was a moment where we were definitely down and out in the job.
But that's always nice, just as you mentioned, the likes of the especially James Can Cruz, you've had good days before that, but I think that just took it to a whole different level, I suppose, what he's done. And I was delighted when I came in that Dolly had the picture there of James Can Cruz competing at an iconic show like Geneva, because we all need those days to get through the
reflect
the challenging
on
ones. You can answer together or separately, but it's the question that I finish each interview with. What advice would you offer to a young breeder or to someone at the start of their breeding program?
Try and buy the best mare line they can
afford.
Afford, yeah.
It's not easy to go out and buy something that's really expensive when you're starting off, and just breed it to the best and hope for the best.
Yeah, I'd probably maybe start with a foal. Sometimes it can be just that little bit easier to get into a foal, or you're starting off your own brand with a foal anyhow. You have whatever you do is your own, you're not buying maybe a problem from someone else, or basically always aim for the highest as you can anyhow and keep going even when the days are bad. The good days will come no matter how bad they get.
And if you were to look back over either the 20 or the 30 years that you've been breeding, are there specific things that stand out that have worked well for you and can be replicated?
I suppose what we do with our young fillies, we cover them at 2-year-olds. Most of them go on forward, some of them don't. And we cover them with a top stallion that's breeding jumpers. And that has worked fairly well.
Yeah, there's a fairly high success rate of the horses coming out performing off them mares in their first foals, which when the foal mare is, we'll say the first foal is 6, your mare is still only 8. Whereas if you wait until a 4-year-old, we don't really produce on our mares either to 140 level and then go breeding. We always, first of all, we couldn't afford to do it when we were trying to be breeding all the mares we were doing. So we decided we were going to give them the best chance and give them the best horse that we thought was suitable for them anyhow. And it has been working fairly successful.
We were discussing it, I think it was before we started recording as well, about those dilemmas where you have that special filly, but in your mind, she can do far more for you by going into your breeding program.
Yeah, well, sure, look, if you're going to try and improve your herd, you have to try and keep the best ones as well, like, even though you would get a lot of money maybe for it. But then if you go out to buy it, you're going to pay a lot of money, so it's 6 of one and half a dozen of the other. So we try and breed. We would buy an odd one to change, you know, to bring into the system.
Into the herd, yeah. I was actually saying that to Dad. We had a foal one time and I owned it and I was getting good money for it and we were to keep it. And I was saying I'd sell it. And he said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going out buying some other foal. And he was like, sure, you have it there, don't we?
Yeah.
You're only taking in money to give it to someone else. He said, you know you're lying. And so that would be our way of doing it anyway.
If you enjoyed this episode or any of the previous episodes, why not send it to a friend or share it on your social media?